I don't know if your DVD had other interviews that didn't go so well. I mean, I imagine sometimes people have not just been, and they may have been a little punchy with you. Is that a fair assessment?
Yes, indeed.
All right. But I don't really know. I guess the point is, like, what is the aim here? Like, what is it you're trying to elicit? Like, what is it? Like, if you're, are you curious, or is this more of just about you? Like, that's the question. Like, are you genuinely curious? Are you interviewing because you want to know something? Or are you interviewing people because this is, like, your shtick and it's what you do? I think you are actually a very serious fan. And I think you have discovered a vehicle in which you're able to engage with people. And it's really successful, clearly. You've been doing it for a long time now. You do very well. But at the same time, it is, to some degree, like, it becomes... at times, it feels a little like it just makes, you know, it makes people feel uncomfortable. Because I think if you and I were to sit down with a cup of tea, for instance, we could talk, and I think I would appreciate that more than having the pace of this interview, this light, a guy with a camera going back and forth. You know, this is a performance.
I guess what I was thinking was, we don't always have that amount of time. You know, we only say I have 20 minutes for an interview or whatever. If we could have a couple hours, yeah, that would be great. I would love to do it. But usually when you only have a bit of time, you have to kind of increase the pace a little bit.
How long have we been talking right now?
I'm not sure. I was just waiting for you to say it's time to leave. But generally, not as long as we would if we were like sitting on an airplane or on a chairlift together.
I think it's quite possible that if we had, in this exact same scenario, have I gotten here and you had done this presentation and I had done the thing I did downstairs and it was all over and we were having some food, I think there's a very good chance you and I could have sat down and talked easily this long right now.
But would I be allowed to record it, though?
That's not a conversation. That's a performance. You could record it, maybe, but it's going to change. It's just going to change the conversation.
Well, I enjoyed the personal nature of it. However, I would feel bad that I'm not recording it so we can't share it with others.
Maybe the way you can share things is by letting the conversation, that exchange, develop within you certain ideas or activities, and then you talk to other people. Like, I have a lot of conversations that are deeply affecting, really encouraging, inspiring conversations that are not being recorded. Those are not, that's not lost time. That is well spent time.
But when you do a radio show every week and the listeners demand and want information, they'd be like, man, you went out for dinner with Ian MacKay? What did you learn? Can we hear the tape? We'd love to hear that. How dare you not share Ian MacKay with us? And that's what I was thinking I was trying to do, just trying to share you. I think it's kind of spoiled if I were to go out to dinner with you and not record it, because I want the information that you say for people to learn about, because I think that's fascinating.
I don't agree with you. But I'm doing your interview. So clearly, I'm willing to talk with you. I'm talking with you. I'm having a conversation with you. All I said was, I would prefer to sit down and talk with you. Like, I was really interested in the bit you did about your mom. That piece of work that you sent me. You sent me a link to a video about your mom. Fascinating. Seemed like a very interesting human being. Clearly somebody who had a deep effect on you. Like, that's interesting to me. But it's not necessarily something that's like, you know, check out this doll, check out this thing, check out this record. Or, you know, that's a different story. I'm just telling you what I would prefer. But I'm standing here.
I appreciate your honesty, Ian. That means a lot. Thank you.
You're welcome.
Well, thanks much, Ian MacKay. Keep on rocking in the free world. And doot, doodaloo, doo.
Doot, doot.
Whoever said money can't buy you friends obviously wasn't a member at CITR. When you become a member, you get the Friends of CITR card with incredible discounts in the downtown area at
The Baker and the Chef, Bang On T-shirts, Beat Street Records, Dunlevy Snack Bar, The Fall Tattooing, Fortune Sound Club, Hits Boutique, Pacific Cinematheque, Perch, The Portside Pub, Save On Meats, and Vinyl Records.
To find out more, visit us in room 233 of the Sub on the UBC campus or go online to citr.ca.
Listen, if they're so hot, how come they're not tearing up the charts, babe?
Because you never play them, babe.
At CITR, our hosts choose the music they play. That means our charts actually reflect the tastes of music lovers, as opposed to focus groups. So if you want to know what's really tearing up the charts, get your hands on a copy of Beatroot or Discorder magazine, or go online to citr.ca. CITR's charts are based on actual spins motivated by actual preference. No payola, no marketing, just good tunes. Refreshing, no?
Right here on News 101.
What motivated you to become a candidate in the provincial election?
The media portrayal of last week's protest that resulted in polarizing images of black-clad activists taking to the streets.
He was just explaining to us the reason why they wanted to show this film on campus.
The official stance is that we are for the Olympics.
News 101 reporter Brad Pepping was there.
By discriminating against homeless people in Vancouver, there's a disproportionate impact on Aboriginal people as well as people with disabilities.
I was pretty outraged. I mean, it is outrageous.
Today is Friday, the 29th of August. I'm Marco.
And I'm Christine. You're listening to News 101 on CITR 101.9 FM, broadcasting to you live from the University of British Columbia. To our UBC campus, to the residents of Vancouver, and to our listeners of our newscast and podcast on our website, citr.ca.
Good evening. It's currently 5:09 p.m., and time for a full hour of independent campus, local, and international news.
All this plus your weekend weather forecast brought to you by Environment Canada.
Today's top stories and segments are Segment 1, our science and technology correspondent Marco's discussion of this week's top science funding.
We also have an interview with Mark Thompson, a retired solder professor who specialized in union relations, to discuss the ongoing BCTF strike.
Later in the program, an interview with two students who are knee-deep in an undesirable housing situation. News correspondent Olamide Olenian caught up with them earlier this week.
But first, some headlines for today. In campus news, new UBC doctoral and postdoctoral researchers impress federal agencies. 32 UBC doctoral students were awarded Vanier Canada graduate scholarships, allowing them to continue research in fields from music therapy to genomics, with each researcher receiving $50,000 a year for 3 years. The total number of Vanier Canada graduate scholarships for this year was 166. In addition, the Banting Postdoctoral Fellowship Program recognized six UBC postdoctoral researchers, awarding each winner $140,000 over 2 years. This year's total number of Banting Postdoctoral Fellowships awarded was 70. Funding for both awards totaled more than $34 million for this year, with the young UBC researchers receiving $5.7 million. The announcements were made by Minister of State, Science and Technology Ed Holder and Leader of the Government in the House of Commons, Peter Van Loan.
In local news, BC Ferry provides profitable, proves profitable following government cuts and service reduction. Earlier today, BC Ferries released its earnings from this year's fiscal first quarter. From April to June of 2014, the corporation showed net earnings of $13.9 million. Compared to last year's $4.3 million, the earnings have more than tripled for the same three-month period. This spike in profits has been attributed to higher fares, transportation fees, and fuel surcharges, coupled with the newly lowered financing costs. BC Ferries representatives remain cautious, saying their gains were offset by lower traffic levels and a 2% jump in operating costs. Ferries President Mike Corrigan said that their catering and retail sectors are a part of the net earnings increase, as well as a 6.6% rise in revenue. BC Ferries' financial success follows cuts to the corporation's funding earlier this year. In March, Provincial Transportation Minister
Moving on to the next story, because of some technical difficulties, let's move on to federal regulators' approved proposal to turn BC's Lower Mainland into one of North America's coal export centers. Yesterday, the Fraser-Surrey docks were officially granted permission to build a coal transfer facility along the Fraser River. The new facility will transfer 4 million tons of U.S. thermal coal from trains to barges bound for a deep-sea terminal of Texada Island before going on to Asian markets across the Pacific. The approval follows 2 years of concerted efforts by activists to oppose the project due to concerns about climate change as well as the possible health risks of coal dust and diesel exhaust. Despite the official approval, Port Metro Vancouver's Vice President of Planning and Operations, Peter Zotta, issued a statement saying that Fraser-Surrey docks will still need to, quote, meet a strict set of conditions when it comes to safety and environmental standards. Minister Zotta added that, quote, through our comprehensive project review process, stakeholder consultation, as well as a third-party validated environmental and health studies, it was determined there are no unacceptable risks and the project could be permitted, end quote. Concerns about the facility were raised by many, including the chief medical health officers of the Vancouver Coastal Health Authority, as well as the cities of New Westminster, Burnaby, and Vancouver. In response, Port Metro Vancouver mandated an environmental impact assessment, despite not being obligated to do so by the provincial or federal governments. The agency predicted that the $15 million facility will boost employment by offering 25 direct and 25 indirect full-time jobs. The Texada Island side of the plans are being legally challenged, and activists have vowed to take the matter to regional air quality regulators. A spokesperson from the organization Voters Taking Action on Climate Change said that, quote, the fight isn't over yet.
I apologize for those technical difficulties. In national news, Canadian National Anthem up for revisions once again. A Toronto city councillor wants to change the lyrics of Canada's national anthem to include more gender-neutral language. Councillor Sita Ram Kalawan Singh will propose a motion at Monday's Toronto Council meeting to change the lines from, quote, in all thy sons command to, quote, in all of us command. Her proposal is an endorsement of the Sing All of Us campaign, which has recently gained popularity and whose supporters include famous author Margaret Atwood. Some at Toronto City Hall, including Mayor Rob Ford, are questioning whether the motion should come before council at all, since it is a federal issue and the city has no power over the anthem. Councillor Ram Kalawan Singh said today, quote, the national anthem is an important symbol in Canada. We should all be represented in it. It's a very small change.
And in international news, Ukraine-Russia tensions mount as convoy crosses border. Today, more than 100 Russian trucks were sent across the violence-torn border in what Moscow said was a mission to deliver humanitarian aid. The Ukrainian government denounced the convoy as a, quote, direct invasion, and NATO, as well as the United States, were quick to follow suit. NATO has also recently announced that it has mounting evidence that Russian forces are operating inside Ukraine and launching artillery attacks from within the country. The convoy entered Ukraine without governmental permission after being held up at the border for a week, amid fears that the mission was a ploy to supply pro-Russian separatists in eastern Ukraine. Russian ambassador to the UN addressed those fears, saying, quote, "We discussed providing humanitarian aid. This is what Russia is doing. The United States does not have a monopoly on humanism," end quote. While Russia maintains that there was, quote, ample possibility for double-checking on the convoy, the White House National Security Council reported that the convoy was comprised of, quote, Russian military vehicles painted to look like civilian trucks, and that, quote, while a small number of these vehicles were inspected by Ukrainian custom officials, most of the vehicles have not been inspected by anyone but Russia.
Those are your campus, local, national, and international headlines on News 101. We're going to take a quick PSA break, but stay tuned.
This week on the Arts Report, film, theater, dance, books, visual art, and more. Every Wednesday at 5 p.m., the Arts Reporters explore what's fun, fascinating, campy, or critical in the Vancouver art scene. You can find bonus content on our Mixcloud, Facebook, and Twitter. Got an idea for a review, interview, or original production? Email arts@citr.ca. Listen Wednesdays at 5 p.m. or anytime on citr.ca.
This is Graymaker.
This is Austin
Blatt. Howdy, folks. We're the Bitterweed Drawn.
This is Zach from Black Breath.
Hi, this is Artie from Broken Bones.
Hello, Vancouver. This is Carolyn Mark.
I'm Water Crime Guide.
This is Dan Mangan.
Hey, this is David Pepke from Denmark.
This is Dylan Ozick from Slingshot.
Hi, this is Dick Valentine from Electric City.
Hi, everybody. This is Fred Penner on the Radio Waves.
This is Brent Schneider.
This is Colin from GBH.
Hi, this is the Gearing Up Inventors.
Hi, this is Bette Dillo from The Gossip.
Hi, this is Brian from Hellshock.
This is Scruffmouth the Scribe.
I'm Shani from NFC.
This is Sab Gray from Iron Cross.
Hey, we're J plus J plus J.
This is Jack Mercer from Jack Mercer and the Whiskey Bandits.
It's James Wood, half of Mega Bear.
This is Jeron Paxton, American musicianer.
This is Swami Bill and the Shameless Weed Hounds from New Orleans, Louisiana, east of the Mississippi.
Hi, this is John Boutte from New Orleans, Louisiana.
This is Jesse Laborde.
I'm Peter Mansbridge.
Hi, this is Ron McLean of Hockey / Movie Night in Canada.
You're listening to CITR 101.9 FM, also on the web, citr.ca, in UBC, University of British Columbia, in Vancouver, Canada. Have our people contact your people, won't you?
Welcome back to News 101. You're listening to us on CITR 101.9 FM, or online at citr.ca, broadcasting live from the University of British Columbia in Vancouver. Thank you for being with us.
Up next, we have our weekly science and technology segment with Marco.
Good afternoon. This is Marco from UBC's AstroTalk. Today we have to start this science and technology news. We have a few stories on super new materials that are being worked on and invented, and one of those is happening in Canada. In our first story, Ottawa-based Graphoid opens research center in Kingston, Ontario. Graphoid is working to make materials and boats, things like that, and to work on oil spills from a new material called graphene. Graphene is a one atom thick layer of graphite that is currently used in things like pencils and hockey sticks. The advantage of using graphite, it is strong, it is waterproof, it is flexible, and it also conducts electricity. The potential uses for graphene could be things like touchscreens, solar panels, and believe it or not, condoms. In recent news, the Gates Foundation in Seattle has awarded a $100,000 grant to a scientist in the University of Manchester to develop a super thin, durable graphene condom. But Graphoid's CEO, Gary Economa, was quoted as saying, "We are not in the market to sell graphene. What we do is put it into polymers. Then we create products with polymers or coatings. So They are working presently on things such as coating the bottom of a boat with the graphene. This will repel the water and have a lot less friction. This will save fuel and lead to having a faster boat. There is an international race to develop graphene technology, or so says the CEO of Graphoid, Economa. Graphene is a super material, and it will become extremely valuable in the future. Other countries and other companies in other countries make graphene by vaporizing it and reassembling it on a piece of copper. This production method costs $200 to $300 per gram. But the Ottawa-based Graphoid has patented a new way to make it for pennies using non-acid chemicals. This is better for the environment, and it also is a cheaper way to do it. In the future, graphene can be used for solar panels, and someone is also experimenting with a solar panel shirt, believe it or not. You can put on the shirt, and it will act like a solar panel. The CEO, Economa, was quoted as saying, Canada is behind now, but in the future, it will become a world leader in the production and the making of graphene. In other news, the Nobel Prize was recently awarded to four years ago, to Andrei Gain and Konstantin Novoselov, shared the Nobel Prize for the groundbreaking experiments with graphene. So graphene looks like a material for the future. Environmentalists are issuing warnings, though. Graphene, although it is a revolutionary material that scientists have said will revolutionize material science, environmentalists have said, have asked what happens when graphene reaches the dumps or reaches the bottoms of the ocean. Yes, it is versatile, it is strong, but more studies are needed and more research is needed to find how it will affect the environment. In the 1930s, a similar material, plastic, transformed our world. It was hailed as a miracle material then. Graphene has the same potential. It is harder than diamonds. It is 200 times stronger than steel. And it is the thinnest material on Earth. In other science news, scientists and engineers are coming up with cool new ID technologies. Presently, we have things like driver's license and holograms on our driver's license to help identify us. And there have been new biometric ID technologies such as fingerprinting or iris scanning. But science and technology is moving into new realms. Here is five new technologies for ID that are going to come in the market soon. We all know that dogs know each person has a unique and recognizable odor. So the challenge for scientists has come up with sensors that can make out smells as good as a dog's nose can. This is important because of identity theft now in our present society. Since 1985, the Technical Institute of Madrid has been collaborating with a Spanish company, Ilia Sistema, which is a Spanish tech firm, to develop new technologies to identify people based on their chemical smell patterns. They have had an 85% success rate, but is still in the research stage. The second new technology is smartphone technology. The sensors in smartphones are predictably imperfect. Each cell phone has a cell phone radio signal that contains unalterable digital fingerprints. So phones can be fingerprinted. In the third way to identify people, how about heartbeats? Heartbeats can be used for digital identification. A company called Bionim, a startup in Toronto, is working now in experimental stages with wristband technology that uses electrical cardiogram waveforms to identify people by their heartbeat. There are unique patterns of electrical activity in every person's heart, And these, when people wear these bracelets called NIMI bracelets, it can authenticate the wearer. The fourth way, the fourth new technology for ID is by the veins. It's called a BioWallet or Pulse Wallet, a machine designed for retailers to identify customers with a quick scan of their veins. The fifth way is called thought process, neuro, sky, mind wave, where people wear a wireless headset to identify them. In other news, the New York airport is using smart lighting to provide surveillance at one of America's biggest airports. New York Airport won't discuss its lighting technologies, but passengers and taxis and cars are being watched by the lighting system. The lights use much less energy. They have computing capabilities and network capabilities. The system has sensors and cameras, so if a bag is left unattended or if somebody is walking through the parking lot in a suspicious manner, these sensors can alert the security people. These can be used in shopping malls and street corners to watch people or record conversations, but there are already alarms that these are too intrusive. In another story of material science, a super black nanocoating is now being tested in space. A new carbon nanotube coating, similar to the previous material we'll discuss, which is very, very thin, is now being tested in the International Space Station. The nano-based material is thin, highly uniform coating of multi-wave nanotubes. It is pure carbon, and it is 10,000 times thinner than a strand of hair. NASA is now testing this in space in the harsher environments and the harsher conditions of space where there is radiation. So nanotube coatings may offer a promising technology on Earth. And in our last story, a high-powered dark energy camera is now in space. It has been launched, and it can see billions of light years away. Scientists have said that the universe is made out of 70% dark energy and about 25% dark matter. These are mysterious forces that act in opposition to gravity. Dark energy, with the theory behind dark energy, this states that the universe is expanding and accelerating, whereas with Einstein's general relativity, the universe should be slowing down. The dark energy camera can capture light of 100,000 galaxies in one shot up to 8 million light years away. It is now in its second year of operation, and the dark energy cam has released some stunning photos. Information about this camera can be found at www.nasa.gov/content/Goddard/NASA captures images. This is Marco. You're up to date with science and technology news.
Thank you, Marco. We are going to take a quick PSA break, but please stay tuned for more contributor segments here on CITR 101.9 FM.
Join the Mount Pleasant Neighborhood House on September 27th from 12 to 6 p.m. in celebration of the diverse Mount Pleasant community at Metamorphfest 2014. Enjoy a fun-filled day full of live music, an interactive art walk, and many activities for children, seniors, and everyone in between. Sponsored by Van City Credit Union.
Fred Durst?
He's like Iggy.
Oh, you are sorely mistaken. I
play something from $3 Bill, y'all.
What is that?
That's the landmark Limp Bizkit album.
Limp Bizkit? Oh, my God. I mean,
Wait, you don't agree that those are the most crucial grooves you've heard since Funkadelic?
What, Limp Bizkit grooves? Yeah, absolutely.
It's like the ultimate cross between Funkadelic and Rob Tyner.
Yeah, no, I don't agree at all.
Oh, you do not deserve a radio show.
CITR 101.9 FM, your crucial groove station. It's just a lot of BS.
Welcome back to News 101. You're listening to us on CITR 101.9 FM or online at citr.ca, broadcasting live from the University of British Columbia in Vancouver. Thank you for being with us.
We now have your local weather forecast for the weekend, brought to you by Environment Canada. So currently, the conditions are mostly cloudy. The temperature is 17.8 degrees Celsius with a humidity of 67%. The wind gust is at 30 kilometers an hour. Tonight, it will be mainly cloudy with 30% chance of showers early this evening with a low of 15. For tomorrow, it is also cloudy with 60% chance of showers in the afternoon and a high of 18. Saturday night, conditions are cloudy with a 60% chance of showers in the evening, then partly cloudy again with a low of 13. And finally, for Sunday, the conditions are cloudy with 60% chance of showers and a high of 18. So that's your weekend forecast brought to you by Vancouver Weather Bulletin, courtesy of Environment Canada.
Up next, we have segment two, an interview with Mark Thompson, a retired solder professor who specialized in industrial relations. News correspondent Morgan Yee spoke with Mark on Wednesday, August 27th, to hear his thoughts and insights into the ongoing BCTF strike.
Welcome to News 101.
I'm glad to be with you.
How likely do you think it is that an agreement will be reached in the next week before classes are supposed to start?
Very unlikely. It's a complicated problem, and they don't seem to be making very much headway, so I don't think it'll happen before the weekend, let's put it like that.
And what do you believe is preventing an agreement from being reached?
They're far apart on a number of important issues, and they have an outstanding mediator who has said he'll help, but only if he thinks there's a chance for settlement, and he hasn't joined them as of this morning. So if he doesn't think it's going to happen, it's probably not going to happen.
So he's going off of that. Do you feel that the role of unions has changed in the last few years?
Yeah, it has, for sure. Now, in the public, the strength of the labor movement now is in the public sector, you know, the teachers and the nurses and QP and those people, and some of whom are at UBC. And in most cases, the unions are focusing on keeping what they have. They're not asking for more or very little more. And employers are attempting to reduce their wages and benefits. So traditionally, well, they were there to raise wages and benefits, but now they're trying to hang on to what they have.
And how do you think that this has impacted public support for these kinds of labor movements?
Well, I think it's hard to generalize. I think in the case of the teachers, for the time being, they have quite a bit of support, given that the strike inconveniences a lot of people. I mean, we know that. Mm-hmm. Given what you gather from the reaction of people on the street and people who write letters to the editor and call in, why I think the teachers have support. I think the reason for that is the teachers are saying it's not about money, it's about class composition. And we can't give a lot of our students the attention they deserve because the classes have too many special needs students and not enough help for us. And the government's answer is we have to balance the budget. I think the teachers are going to win that argument. It resonates more with the public than we got to balance the budget.
Now, looking at QP, because they have accepted an agreement, how do you think their acceptance of an agreement has impacted the teachers' negotiations?
Not much at all. I mean, one of the problems that in these negotiations are that the government sees the teachers as another public sector union, which they are. But they see themselves as a kind of a social movement, an advocate for education funding and those kinds of issues. And they don't much care what the other unions did because they're not assuming that role in society.
And do you think that's an appropriate role for the BC teacher union to take?
Well, I think in a democratic country, they're free to take the positions that they want. I'm just saying that it's unusual. Mostly public sector unions are interested in the same kind of issues that other unions are, you know, pay and time off and job security for their members. But the teachers are not going down that road.
Later on today, I'll be speaking with someone who's been organizing a social media campaign to try to start a general strike in BC.
A general strike?
Yes. What do you think of that?
Oh, my goodness. we haven't had a general strike in BC in about 60, 70 years, so I think it'll be tough. I mean, a general strike is a quintessentially political action. I mean, most strikes, you know, pits an employer against a union as a kind of a test of economic strength. When you get into the public sector, it's a more of a political contest than an economic contest. The government saves money when the teachers are on strike, which is, you know, very much contrary to what the what happens in the private sector. So it's not economic, but if enough parents and members of the public say, we want this settled and the teachers have a point, that's pressure that the government, you know, does and really should respond to. That doesn't mean they'll do what the teachers want, but that's always on their minds. So it's a different dynamic. So to that extent, a general strike kind of veers a little bit more toward the what is now the conventional public sector strike. But I can assure you that there will be no appetite in the labor movement in general for having its members give up their pay and incur possible penalties in order to support the teachers.
In terms of the BCTF union, do you think that coming out of this, there will be some significant changes in the leadership structure?
That it's a very political union. They have contested elections. I have lots of people who are former teachers, or better yet, former principals, tell me, the one faction controls the microphones at the conventions and yada, yada. But teachers are intelligent. Most of them are graduates of UBC. They have the right to cast their votes. And they elected Mr. Eicher by a strong margin just a few months ago. So I don't think there'll be a change.
Thank you very much.
You're welcome. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Welcome back. This is Marco on CITR 101.9. Unfortunately, Morgan was unable to get in touch with her second contact, a man from BC who created a Facebook group to rally BC workers to conduct a mass strike. But listeners can check out his page by searching BC General Strike.
For our next segment on the show, we have an interview with two students who are knee-deep in undesirable housing situation. News correspondent Olamide Olanian caught up with them earlier this week.
My name is Olamide Olanian, reporting for News 101 to you from UBC Vancouver campus. I am here interviewing two very stressed, frantic, and desperate young men who are looking for housing in the great rush of back-to-school season. Would you like to introduce yourselves?
My name is Oleg Tuzlikov. I'm a second-year art student.
And my name is Philippe Roberge. I'm a second-year science student. We're both internationals.
So, why don't you tell me about your hustle for on-campus residence? How is that working out for you?
Pretty poorly. I've been number 200 on the wait list for over 2 weeks. You know, I started first notice in April that I was like 1,000-something for winter housing. So I expected there to be progress, but there isn't really any. So I gave up on UBC housing option, basically.
Yeah. I think one of the main problems with on-campus housing, especially for winter session, is that the school has a lottery system employed. So there is no preference given to people who have no relatives in Vancouver, where, you know, preference given where it should be. For example, Oleg is a Russian student. We're just going to use ourselves here. Oleg is a Russian student. He doesn't have any relatives whatsoever in North America as a whole, much less in Vancouver.
Yep.
So how is it conceivably fair that someone with a house in Kitsilano and a car with a 5-minute commute would be given housing in, for example, in Marine Drive, whereas Oleg, whose closest relative is more than 7,000 kilometers away, is not. It does not make sense.
It's very stressful, and you know, I'm a good student, you know, not even mentioning the fact that, you know, international tuition is just huge, you know. I just feel sort of cheated by this system of the university that I feel like I'm contributing to and not getting anything in return.
That is a very interesting way of looking at things. Maybe in the same way that there is preferred first-year student residence, there could be preferred international housing. A major difference is that first years require a safe place to study and assimilate comfortably into the campus community. However, it can still be looked at in the same lens. International students already pay so much and go through culture shock, and risk everything to come to a school that is far away from home. Perhaps they too should have a safe place to study and assimilate as well, and not have homelessness as a significant worry. So, Philippe, what do you think is a major problem for lack of student housing?
I think one of the main problems with the housing is that the school allows many nice condos and high-rises to be built on the campus, but they don't give preference for the housing choices to the students. Oftentimes, you'll see that the people, the landlords of the properties on UBC have nothing to do with UBC apart from the fact that they live there.
The academia.
They might not even, they don't even work at UBC, they don't even have students that go to UBC. They just live there because they find it nice, and sure it is, but you'd think that it would be a priority for students to live there.
Yeah.
Why not?
Okay, do you propose any better system of allocating housing?
Well, they say they don't give priority, which I personally highly doubt. But still, I think they should reconsider it. For example, maybe not all the priority to international students, but, you know,
to take that into
consideration.
A sort of solution would to have a sort of bracket that would, a certain quota that can only be filled by international students or students who don't live within a certain radius of the campus or don't have any relatives or any house
again,
within the radius.
Reestablishing just for international students, we're not proposing that. Again, you know, Phil is a Canadian citizen, so...
Yeah. If I just don't have any relatives in the area or close, not even close to here.
Yeah, so the system should be reconsidered.
Okay, how about your search for houses since you can't get a place in UBC campus?
It's been very competitive.
Very challenging.
Lots of people, you know, oftentimes you'll go to a house to a viewing and you expect to have an intimate conversation with the real estate agent, and all of a sudden there's, you know, 15, 20, even 30 people we've seen.
Yeah.
We just come to, you know, a bunch of viewings, and it's not like, you know, conversation with some person. You know, you barely ever, you know, meet the landlord. A bunch of times we went to places where landlords actually don't even live in Canada, you know? They just hire these agents and who hold, you know, viewings with, you know, 30, 40 people and going through the same apartment
and
every day.
That's also especially frustrating because you feel like these landlords are just using the university, like, property to make their own money. They don't care at all for the university.
Yeah.
It does nothing for the university.
Yeah, so... In as a result of that, because there's so much competition and there's, you know, so many people, not just, you know, want a nice house, you know, people need a place to stay, and it's like the basic necessity, food and shelter. And, you know, when it becomes necessary to fight for this place, you know, people start playing dirty. And one of the things we've encountered in searching for houses outside of residence options, that people, you know, play dirty. We've seen people lie, you know, about, you know, just to get their place.
We had this one girl.
Yeah.
So we went to a viewing, and we met her at the viewing, and she said she was a grad student.
Yeah.
And we found out later that she actually ended up getting the apartment. Then we went to a jumpstart sort of first year kind of gathering, and we saw her there, and she told us that she was in first year.
Yeah.
Whereas she had told the landlord that she was actually a post-grad student working on her master's.
Yeah, and she got the apartment.
She got the apartment through lying. This is a common tactic. We've seen it more than once.
So basically, in the housing market, the prospective buyers go through dirty tactics to get what they want, right? Are there any other experiences about this?
There are other tactics. Some I wouldn't call tactics. There's also this sort of scene of, there is some racial profiling. I mean, we can't look away from it. It's true. I mean, you yourself probably have experienced.
Yeah, there's definite, like, you know, I understand UBC is not a very welcoming school from people from all over the world, but in terms of housing in Vancouver in general, there is definitely preferences based on racial and ethnic belongings.
Mm. Do you care to explain that a little bit more?
Oftentimes you'll see that they will mark looking for Asian students.
Yes, but so even like looking for Asian students, like, what do you even mean? It's very, so just shows how it's very difficult to search for housing in this sort of environment where there are so many factors working against you.
There's high competition, you know, dirty play employed by other prospective renters. It's just, it is a very stressful time. I do believe that a few weeks ago, CTV had a special report about how there was almost, I think, 4,000 UBC students that were still without housing this year. And I think this really needs to be taken up by the university. They need to have a solution in order to give housing to the students who need it, because it's not fair that students, you know, who work at the university, who love their university, should have to go through all this stress.
Yeah, it is absurd.
It is completely absurd.
Yeah, and if, once again, for especially for international students that already pay so much, you know, I mean, speaking from personal experience, but it is very, very difficult.
As proposed victims of the system, how do you maximize your chances of receiving housing in UBC?
We're not proud to do it, but, you know, if everyone's playing dirty, you kind of have to employ your own tactics, too.
Yeah.
Bribing is there. It's not something we can just turn a blind eye to, and oftentimes we know that the apartment has been taken by someone.
Yeah, those who pay higher do get the apartment.
And it's because, you know, money runs the world, and that's just the way it is. But it's just, it's a shame also for, you know, for students who don't have all that money. It just makes it that much harder for them, you know.
And again, students are put into this situation, you know, to deal with this, you know, rough competition, to, you know, bribing people and putting too much money of their own because rest housing is not there. That's like simple as that. And I think instead of, you know, for example, looking for solutions, you know, to improve kind of housing situation, you know, around the UBC or Vancouver area, you know, we should, you know, go to the source. You know, we shouldn't treat the symptoms. If we fix the resident system in UBC, then people shouldn't be even involved in things like this.
So how has this been affecting your day-to-day life, your social life, academics, all that?
School starts in September. If you don't have a house by the time school starts, you have a lot to deal with on your plate.
Yeah, I think you when we came here, you asked us, you know, how does the, you know, search affect it, kind of like our social
day-to-day life,
social, academic. I know I've... You know, it's school hasn't even started yet, but, you know, I feel uncomfortable sometimes going to, like, you know, social events, meeting my friends, because, you know, this idea is, like, always in the back of my head.
It's,
you know, I feel guilty, you know, even if I cleared everything on my PadMapper, or, you know, I'm like, I'm not looking for an apartment, I'm going to be homeless, I can't, you know, go have fun. And, you know, same goes for, like, you know, for academic life, you know. I prioritize all my time looking for houses and just don't put as much as I can for school, and I'm just nervous right now how it's going to be when school kicks in.
How things are going to turn out.
Yeah. Yeah.
I wish them all the best. My name is Olamide Olanion, reporting for News 101 to you from UBC Vancouver campus.
Up next on News 101, we are pleased to present an episode of Wings entitled Refugee Women Learn. This is a shorter version, and this series is produced by Frida Worden. And this episode was produced and hosted by Portia Larley.
Today on Wings.
The Thailand-based We Women Foundation focuses on supporting women who dedicate their lives to advocate for those suffering in the wake of Myanmar's military regime. We Women seeks to empower these unrecognized refugee and migrant women from Myanmar by providing them with professional and educational opportunities.
There's a river of birds in migration, a nation of women with wings. There's
Welcome to Wings, a series of news and current affairs programs by and about women around the world, produced and distributed by the Women's International News Gathering Service.
Wings contributing producer Portia Larley is currently in Chiang Mai, Thailand. She visited an organization there called We Women, which helps refugee women from Burma get a strong education. Here's Portia.
Myanmar, the Southeast Asian country also known as Burma, is currently emerging from nearly 5 decades of military rule, which resulted in the flight of nearly 2 million people who took refuge on the Thai border. Like countless other migrants and refugees, we women participant, Seng Shaden, left Myanmar to escape a dire economic, social, and political situation. Seng Shaden, a Kachin woman from Khut Kai in Myanmar's eastern Shan state, grew up in a civil war area controlled in part by the Kachin Independence Army, other small militias, and the Myanmar government. Seng Shaden describes her experience working as a child laborer for the Myanmar government. She describes stepping into the role to protect her brother at age 10.
Always the government give order to these local people first to work as labor. We'll carry bamboo for making new roofs for their office, or, you know, carry wood or rice, or you have to give this thing. And then today we need to do this thing, so come 1% from your house, like that. And at the time also I was very young, but, you know, I feel worried for my older brother. If my older brother go to work like that, they will send my brother to front line. So I feel worried for that sense. So, okay, I should go to work, you know. And then if we don't go, if we are not follow their order, we have to pay the money. So, and then we don't have money because my mom is a lower salary. And then I also the very young, my older brother also, he cannot going around freely because he is a man. Whenever he went somewhere, and then, you know, always a lot of check by. And then if they think that they need immediately some help, or if they need to do the something, they just, you know, catching you without reason and send there some. We don't know where we should go to fight. Sometimes it's we lose our family member. That's kind of the situation is often in our life. So that's why I must go it. Walk between 10 and 14.
At age 13, Seng Shaden decided she did not want to become a teacher, a traditionally female role offering little pay. Seng Shaden recognized the limits of the Myanmar education system and decided to focus on starting a business. She started by selling vegetables to local markets and eventually started buying soaps and lipstick in China to sell in Shan State.
The first time I start to sell the vegetable bought from our location and then sold to the market. And later on, I start to doing that a bigger business. I went to the Shui Li and then bought some kind of thing and clothes or, you know, like lipstick. I bought that kind of thing and sold back to our country. But the thing is our country policy is, you know, unstable policy, and then the currency also unstable, and then a lot of corruption. So whenever we bought the thing, you know, we have to give a lot of money to the every check buy. So that means it's a double charge to our thing. And then when we go to sell the market, we can't get that all money. And actually that I feel so strong. My age 13, I do very hard work and I sleep, you know, 3 hours one day. All the time I'm working. But the thing is, I lose the one life. That means it's a teenage life experience. Yeah, I never know that. And the thing, you know, how that one is the impact for my life, you know. I don't know how to smile. And my mom, when I went back to home, my mom forced me, oh, go enjoy the dish picnic or something, like you have to make some fun for your life. And I go enjoy with my same age, but I don't know how to smile. They are very happy to enjoy at the movement. But, you know, they found us something and they are laughing each other and smiling each other. But for me, it's my feeling is that it's not touching with me. And I don't know if all this should be a funny thing or not, you know, that kind of thing. And yeah, I miss one life. I don't know that experience.
Seng Shaden dreamed of advocating for her people and ending the oppression of the Kachin. She describes arriving in Chiang Mai, a city in northern Thailand, in 2001, and beginning to work as a volunteer for KWAT, the Kachin Women's Association Thailand.
I took a lot of responsibility for my family and for myself too, because I don't want to be, you know, live the same level all the time, and I want to be grow up. The same time, I want to be, very very strong emotion. That is, I want to be sure and fight back to the majority Burmese group. Because whenever we went somewhere, or all the time, the Burmese government, or Burmese people took the higher position, and they always discriminate and they insult me a lot. and insult our people because our people can't speak very well Burmese language, and at the same time they don't understand most of our people using their own language, just Burmese language in school. That's made me also very upset, and I feel so strong. And okay, we Kachin also have smart women and clever women. I will show you. I want to show you one day, you know, in Burma, you know, that if I just doing simple way to try to keep try to reach my goal, I will never be reach my goal because this system is not changed yet. And I connect with that my uncle, and then she's brought me to the Thailand, and then I start to join with the Kachin Women Association.
That was our condensed version of Wings. That's our program for today, August 29th. Today's newscast was brought to you by volunteer efforts. If you'd like to share your comments, get involved, or give us an important news tip, contact us through our email, news@citr.ca. You can subscribe to our podcast and listen to our latest interviews and segments on our website, citr.ca/news. For more independent news, join us next Friday at 5 p.m. for another edition of News 101. I'm Marco.
And I'm Christine. Today's show was produced by Valerio. From the entire news team at CITR, thank you for listening. And please stay tuned for Stranded, right here on CITR 101.9 FM.